in compensation of 100 or even 50 pieces of gold. Had these laws been regulated by any principle of equity or reason, the public protection should have supplied in just proportion the want of personal strength. But the legislator had weighed in the scale not of justice but of policy the loss of a soldier against that of a slave. The head of an insolent and rapacious barbarian was guarded by a heavy fine, and the slightest aid was afforded to the most defenseless subjects. Time insensibly abated the pride of the conquerors and the patience of the vanquished, and the boldest citizen was taught by experience that he might suffer more injuries than he could inflict. As the manners of the Franks became less ferocious, their laws were rendered more severe, and the Merovingian kings attempted to imitate the impartial rigor of the Visigoths and Burgundians. Under the empire of Charlemagne, murder was universally punished with death, and the use of capital punishments has been liberally multiplied in the jurisprudence of modern Europe. The civil and military professions, which had been separated by Constantine, were again united by the barbarians. The harsh sound of the Teutonic appellations was mollified into the Latin titles of duke, of count, or of prefect, and the same officer assumed within his district the command of the troops and the administration of justice. But the fierce and illiterate chieftain was seldom qualified to discharge the duties of a judge, which required all the faculties of a philosophic mind, laboriously cultivated by experience and study. And his rude ignorance was compelled to embrace some simple and visible methods of ascertaining the cause of justice. In every religion, the deity has been invoked to confirm the truth or to punish the falsehood of human testimony. But this powerful instrument was misapplied and abused by the simplicity of the German legislators. The party accused might justify his innocence by producing before their tribunal a number of friendly witnesses who solemnly declared their belief or assurance that he was not guilty. According to the weight of the charge, this legal number of compurgators was multiplied. 72 voices were required to absolve an incendiary or assassin. And when the chastity of a queen of France was suspected, 300 gallant nobles swore without hesitation that the infant prince had been actually begotten by her deceased husband. The sin and scandal of manifest and frequent perjuries engaged the magistrates to remove these dangerous temptations and to supply the defects of human testimony by the famous experiments of fire and water. These extraordinary trials were so capriciously contrived that in some cases guilt and innocence in others could not be proved without the interposition of a miracle. Such miracles were really provided by fraud and credulity. The most intricate causes were determined by this easy and infallible method, and the turbulent barbarians, who might have disdained the sentence of the magistrate, submissively acquiesced in the judgment of God. But the trials by single combat gradually obtained the superior credit and authority among a warlike people, who could not believe that a brave man deserved to suffer, or that a coward deserved to live. Both in civil and criminal proceedings, the plaintiff or accuser, the defendant or even the witness, were exposed to mortal challenge from the antagonist who was destitute of legal proofs, and it was incumbent on them either to desert their cause or publicly to maintain their honor in the lists of battle. They fought either on foot or on horseback according to the custom of their nation, and the decision of the sword or lance was ratified by the sanction of heaven, of the judge, and of the people. This sanguinary law was introduced into Gaul by the Burgundians, and their legislator Gundobald condescended to answer the complaints and objections of his subject, Avitus. "Is it not true," said the king of Burgundy to the bishop, "that the event of national wars and private combats is directed by the judgment of God, and that his providence awards the victory to the juster cause?" By such prevailing arguments, the absurd and cruel practice of judicial duels, which had been peculiar to some tribes of Germany, was propagated and established in all the monarchies of Europe, from Sicily to the Baltic. At the end of 10 centuries, the reign of legal violence was not totally extinguished, and the ineffectual censures of saints, of popes, and of synods may seem to prove that the influence of superstition is weakened by its unnatural alliance with reason and humanity. The tribunals were stained with the blood, perhaps, of innocent and respectable citizens. The law, which now favors the rich, then yielded to the strong, and the old, the feeble, and the infirm were condemned either to renounce their fairest claims and possessions to sustain the dangers of an unequal conflict, or to trust the doubtful aid of a mercenary champion. This oppressive jurisprudence was imposed on the provincials of Gaul, who complained of any injuries in their persons and property. Whatever might be the strength or courage of individuals, the victorious barbarians excelled in the love and exercise of arms, and the vanquished Roman was unjustly summoned to repeat, in his own person, the bloody contest which had been already decided against his country. A devouring host of 120,000 Germans had formerly passed the Rhine under the command of Ariovistus. 1/3 part of the fertile lands of the Sequani was appropriated to their use, and the conqueror soon repeated his oppressive demand of another 1/3 for the accommodation of a new colony of 24,000 barbarians whom he had invited to share the rich harvest of Gaul. At the distance of 500 years, the Visigoths and Burgundians, who revenged the defeat of Ariovistus, usurped the same unequal proportion of 2/3 of the subject lands. But this distribution, instead of spreading over the province, may be reasonably confined to the peculiar districts where the victorious people had been planted by their own choice, or by the policy of their leader. In these districts, each barbarian was connected by the ties of hospitality with some Roman provincial. To this unwelcome guest, the proprietor was compelled to abandon 2/3 of his patrimony, but the German, a shepherd and a hunter, might sometimes content himself with a spacious range of wood and pasture, and resign the smallest, though most valuable, portion to the toil of the industrious husbandman. The silence of ancient and authentic testimony has encouraged an opinion that the rapine of the Franks was not moderated or disguised by the forms of a legal division, that they dispersed themselves over the provinces of Gaul without order or control, and that each victorious robber, according to his wants, his avarice, and his strength, measured with his sword the extent of his new inheritance. At a distance from their sovereign, the barbarians might indeed be tempted to exercise such arbitrary depredation. But the firm and artful policy of Clovis must curb a licentious spirit, which would aggravate the misery of the vanquished, whilst it corrupted the union and discipline of the conquerors. The memorable vase of Soissons is a monument and a pledge of the regular distribution of the Gallic spoils. It was the duty and the interest of Clovis to provide rewards for a successful army, settlements for a numerous people, without inflicting any wanton or superfluous injuries on the loyal Catholics of Gaul. The ample fund which he might lawfully acquire of the imperial patrimony, vacant lands and Gothic usurpations, would diminish the cruel necessity of seizure and confiscation, and the humble provincials would more patiently acquiesce in the equal and regular distribution of their loss. The wealth of the Merovingian princes consisted in their extensive domain. After the conquest of Gaul, they still delighted in the rustic simplicity of their ancestors. The cities were abandoned to solitude and decay, and their coins, their charters, and their synods are still inscribed with the names of the villas or rural palaces in which they successively resided. 160 of these palaces, a title which need not excite any unseasonable ideas of art or luxury, were scattered through the provinces of their kingdom, and if some might claim the honours of a fortress, the far greater part could be esteemed only in the light of profitable farms. The mansion of the long-haired kings was surrounded with convenient yards and stables for the cattle and the poultry. The garden was planted with useful vegetables. The various trades, the labours of agriculture, and even the arts of hunting and fishing were exercised by servile hands for the emolument of the sovereign. His magazines were filled with corn and wine, either for sale or consumption, and the whole administration was conducted by the strictest maxims of private economy. This ample patrimony was appropriated to supply the hospitable plenty of Clovis and his successors, and to reward the fidelity of their brave companions, who, both in peace and war, were devoted to their personal service. Instead of a horse or a suit of armour, each companion, according to his rank or merit or favour, was invested with a benefice, the primitive name and most simple form of the feudal possessions. These gifts might be resumed at the pleasure of the sovereign, and his feeble prerogative derived some support from the influence of his liberality. But this dependent tenure was gradually abolished by the independent and rapacious nobles of France, who established the perpetual property and hereditary succession of their benefices, a revolution salutary to the earth, which had been injured or neglected by its precarious masters. Besides these royal and beneficiary estates, a large proportion had been assigned in the division of Gaul of alloidial and Salic lands. They were exempt from tribute, and the Salic lands were equally shared among the male descendants of the Franks. In the bloody discord and silent decay of the Merovingian line, a new order of tyrants arose in the provinces who, under the appellation of signors or lords, usurped a right to govern and a license to oppress the subjects of their peculiar territory. Their ambition might be checked by the hostile resistance of an equal, but the laws were extinguished, and the sacrilegious barbarians who dared to provoke the vengeance of a saint or bishop would seldom respect the landmarks of a profane and defenseless neighbour. The common or public rights of nature, such as they had always been deemed by the Roman jurisprudence, were severely restrained by the German conquerors, whose amusement, or rather passion, was the exercise of hunting. The vague dominion which man has assumed over the wild inhabitants of the earth, the air, and the waters was confined to some fortunate individuals of the human species. Gaul was again overspread with woods, and the animals who were reserved for the use or pleasure of the lord might ravage with impunity the fields of his industrious vassals. The chase was the sacred privilege of the nobles and their domestic servants. Plebeian transgressors were legally chastised with stripes and imprisonment, but in an age which admitted a slight composition for the life of a citizen, it was a capital crime to destroy a stag or a wild bull within the precincts of the royal forests. According to the maxims of ancient war, the conqueror became the lawful master of the enemy whom he had subdued and spared, and the fruitful cause of personal bravery, which had been almost suppressed by the peaceful sovereignty of Rome, was again revived and multiplied by the perpetual hostilities of the independent barbarians. The Goth, the Burgundian, or the Frank, who returned from a successful expedition, dragged after him a long train of sheep, of oxen, and of human captives, whom he treated with the same brutal contempt. The youths of an elegant form and an ingenuous aspect were set apart for the domestic service, a doubtful situation which alternately exposed them to the favourable or cruel impulse of passion. The useful mechanics and servants, smiths, carpenters, tailors, shoemakers, cooks, gardeners, dyers, and workmen in gold and silver, etc., employed their skill for the use or profit of their master. But the Roman captives, who were destitute of art but capable of labour, were condemned, without regard to their former rank, to tend the cattle and cultivate the lands of the barbarians. the number of the hereditary bondsmen who were attached to the Gallic estates was continually increased by new supplies, and the servile people, according to the situation and temper of their lords, was sometimes raised by precarious indulgence, and more frequently depressed by capricious despotism. An absolute power of life and death was exercised by these lords, and when they married their daughters, a train of useful servants, chained on the wagons to prevent their escape, was sent as a nuptial present into a distant country. The majesty of the Roman laws protected the liberty of each citizen against the rash effects of his own distress or despair. But the subjects of the Merovingian kings might alienate their personal freedom, and this act of legal suicide, which was familiarly practiced, is expressed in terms most disgraceful and afflicting to the dignity of human nature. The example of the poor, who purchased life by the sacrifice of all that can render life desirable, was gradually imitated by the feeble and the devout, who in times of public disorder pusillanimously crowded to shelter themselves under the battlements of a powerful chief and around the shrine of a popular saint. Their submission was accepted by these temporal or spiritual patrons, and the hasty transaction irrecoverably fixed their own condition and that of their latest posterity. From the reign of Clovis, during five successive centuries, the laws and manners of Gaul uniformly tended to promote the increase and to confirm the duration of personal servitude. Time and violence almost obliterated the intermediate ranks of society and left an obscure and narrow interval between the noble and the slave. This arbitrary and recent division has been transformed by pride and prejudice into a national distinction, universally established by the arms and the laws of the Merovingians. The nobles, who claim their genuine or fabulous descent from the independent and victorious Franks, have asserted and abused the indefeasible right of conquest over a prostrate crowd of slaves and plebeians to whom they imputed the imaginary disgrace of Gallic or Roman extraction. The general state and revolutions of France, a name which was imposed by the conquerors, may be illustrated by the particular example of a province, a diocese, or a senatorial family. Auvergne had formerly maintained a just preeminence among the independent states and cities of Gaul. The brave and numerous inhabitants displayed a singular trophy, the sword of Caesar himself, which he had lost when he was repulsed before the walls of Gergovia. As the common offspring of Troy, they claimed a fraternal alliance with the Romans, and if each province had imitated the courage and loyalty of Auvergne, the fall of the Western Empire might have been prevented or delayed. They firmly maintained the fidelity which they had reluctantly sworn to the Visigoths, but when their bravest nobles had fallen in the Battle of Poitiers, they accepted, without resistance, a victorious and Catholic sovereign. This easy and valuable conquest was achieved and possessed by Theodoric, the eldest son of Clovis, but the remote province was separated from his Austrasian dominions by the intermediate kingdoms of Soissons, Paris, and Orléans, which formed, after their father's death, the inheritance of his three brothers. The king of Paris, Childebert, was tempted by the neighborhood and beauty of Auvergne. The upper country, which rises towards the south into the mountains of the Cevennes, presented a rich and various prospect of woods and pastures. The sides of the hills were clothed with vines, and each eminence was crowned with a villa or castle. In the lower Auvergne, the river Allier flows through the fair and spacious plain of Limagne, and the inexhaustible fertility of the soil supplied, and still supplies, without any interval of repose, the constant repetition of the same harvests. On the false report that their lawful sovereign had been slain in Germany, the city and diocese of Auvergne were betrayed by the grandson of Sidonius Apollinaris. Childebert enjoyed this clandestine victory, than the free subjects of Theodoric threatened to desert his standard if he indulged his private resentment while the nation was engaged in the Burgundian War. But the Franks of Austrasia soon yielded to the persuasive eloquence of their king. "Follow me," said Theodoric, "into Auvergne. I will lead you into a province where you may acquire gold, silver, slaves, cattle, and precious apparel to the full extent of your wishes. I repeat my promise. I give you the people and their wealth as your prey, and you may transport them at pleasure into your own country." By the execution of this promise, Theodoric justly forfeited the allegiance of a people whom he devoted to destruction. His troops, reinforced by the fiercest barbarians of Germany, spread desolation over the fruitful face of Auvergne. And two places only, a strong castle and a holy shrine, were saved or redeemed from their licentious fury. The castle of Maroliac was seated on a lofty rock which rose 100 feet above the surface of the plain, and a large reservoir of fresh water was enclosed with some arable lands within the circle of its fortifications. The Franks beheld with envy and despair this impregnable fortress, but they surprised a party of 50 stragglers, and as they were oppressed by the number of their captives, they fixed, at a trifling ransom, the alternative of life or death for these wretched victims, whom the cruel barbarians were prepared to massacre on the refusal of the garrison. Another detachment penetrated as far as Briva, or Brioude, where the inhabitants, with their valuable effects, had taken refuge in the sanctuary of St. Julian. The doors of the church resisted the assault, but a daring soldier entered through a window of the choir and opened a passage to his companions. The clergy and people, the sacred and the profane spoils, were rudely torn from the altar, and the sacrilegious division was made at a small distance from the town of Brioude. But this act of impiety was severely chastised by the devout son of Clovis. He punished with death the most atrocious offenders, left their secret accomplices to the vengeance of St. Julian, released the captives, restored the plunder, and extended the rites of sanctuary 5 miles round the sepulchre of the holy martyr. Part 4. Before the Austrasian army retreated from Auvergne, Theodoric exacted some pledges of the future loyalty of a people whose just hatred could be restrained only by their fear. A select band of noble youths, the sons of the principal senators, was delivered to the conqueror as the hostages of the faith of Childebert and of their countrymen. On the first rumor of war or conspiracy, these guiltless youths were reduced to a state of servitude, and one of them, Attalus, whose adventures are more particularly related, kept his master's horses in the diocese of Trier. After a painful search, he was discovered in this unworthy occupation by the emissaries of his grandfather, Gregory, Bishop of Langres. But his offers of ransom were sternly rejected by the avarice of the barbarian, who required an exorbitant sum of 10 pounds of gold for the freedom of his noble captive. His deliverance was effected by the hardy stratagem of Leo, an item belonging to the kitchens of the Bishop of Langres. An unknown agent easily introduced him into the same family. The barbarian purchased Leo for the price of 12 pieces of gold, and was pleased to learn that he was deeply skilled in the luxury of an episcopal table. "Next Sunday," said the Frank, "I shall invite my neighbors and kinsmen. Exert thy art, and force them to confess that they have never seen or tasted such an entertainment even in the king's house." Leo assured him that if he would provide a sufficient quantity of poultry, his wishes should be satisfied. The master, who already aspired to the merit of elegant hospitality, assumed as his own the praise which the voracious guests unanimously bestowed on his cook, and the dexterous Leo insensibly acquired the trust and management of his household. After the patient expectation of a whole year, he cautiously whispered his design to Attalus and exhorted him to prepare for flight in the ensuing night. At the hour of midnight, the intemperate guests retired from the table, and the Frank's son-in-law, whom Leo attended to his apartment with a nocturnal potation, condescended to jest on the facility with which he might betray his trust. The intrepid slave, after sustaining this dangerous raillery, entered his master's bedchamber, removed his spear and shield, silently drew the fleetest horses from the stable, unbarred the ponderous gates, and excited Attalus to save his life and liberty by incessant diligence. Their apprehensions urged them to leave their horses on the banks of the Meuse. They swam the river, wandered 3 days in the adjacent forest, and subsisted only by the accidental discovery of a wild plum tree. As they lay concealed in a dark thicket, they heard the noise of horses. They were terrified by the angry countenance of their master, and they anxiously listened to his declaration that if he could seize the guilty fugitives, one of them he would cut in pieces with his sword, and would expose the other on a gibbet. At length, Attalus and his faithful Leo reached the friendly habitation of a prester of Reims, who recruited their fainting strength with bread and wine, concealed them from the search of their enemy, and safely conducted them beyond the limits of the Austrasian kingdom to the episcopal palace of Langres. Gregory embraced his grandson with tears of joy, gratefully delivered Leo with his whole family from the yoke of servitude, and bestowed on him the property of a farm where he might end his days in happiness and freedom. Perhaps this singular adventure, which is marked with so many circumstances of truth and nature, was related by Attalus himself to his cousin or nephew, the first historian of the Franks. Gregory of Tours was born about 60 years after the death of Sidonius Apollinaris, and their situation was almost similar, since each of them was a native of Auvergne, a senator and a bishop. The difference of their style and sentiments may therefore express the decay of Gaul, and clearly ascertain how much in so short a space the human mind had lost of its energy and refinement. We are now qualified to despise the opposite and perhaps artful misrepresentations which have softened or exaggerated the oppression of the Romans of Gaul under the reign of the Merovingians. The conquerors never promulgated any universal edict of servitude or confiscation, but a degenerate people who excused their weakness by the specious names of politeness and peace was exposed to the arms and laws of the ferocious barbarians, who contemptuously insulted their possessions, their freedom, and their safety. Their personal injuries were partial and irregular, but the great body of the Romans survived the revolution and still preserved the property and privileges of citizens. A large portion of their lands was exacted for the use of the Franks, but they enjoyed the remainder, exempt from tribute, and the same irresistible violence which swept away the arts and manufactures of Gaul destroyed the elaborate and expensive system of imperial despotism. The provincials must frequently deplore the savage jurisprudence of the Salic or Ripuarian laws, but their private life in the important concerns of marriage, testaments, or inheritance was still regulated by the Theodosian Code, and a discontented Roman might freely aspire or descend to the title and character of a barbarian. The honors of the state were accessible to his ambition. The education and temper of the Romans more peculiarly qualified them for the offices of civil government, and as soon as emulation had rekindled their military ardor, they were permitted to march in the ranks or even at the head of the victorious Germans. I shall not attempt to enumerate the generals and magistrates whose names attest the liberal policy of the Merovingians. The supreme command of Burgundy, with the title of patrician, was successively entrusted to 3 Romans, and the last and most powerful, Mummulus, who alternately saved and disturbed the monarchy, had supplanted his father in the station of Count of Autun, and left a treasury of 30 talents of gold and 250 talents of silver. The fierce and illiterate barbarians were excluded during several generations from the dignities and even from the orders of the church. The clergy of Gaul consisted almost entirely of native provincials. The haughty Franks fell at the feet of their subjects, who were dignified with the episcopal character, and the power and riches which had been lost in war were insensibly recovered by superstition. In all the temporal affairs, the Theodosian Code was the universal law of the clergy, but the barbaric jurisprudence had liberally provided for their personal safety. A subdeacon was equivalent to 2 francs. The antrustion and priest were held in similar estimation, and the life of a bishop was appreciated far above the common standard at the price of 900 pieces of gold. The Romans communicated to their conquerors the use of the Christian religion and Latin language, but their language and their religion had alike degenerated from the simple purity of the Augustan and apostolic age. The progress of superstition and barbarism was rapid and universal. The worship of the saints concealed from vulgar eyes the God of the Christians, and the rustic dialect of peasants and soldiers was corrupted by Teutonic idiom and pronunciation. Yet such intercourse of sacred and social communion eradicated the distinctions of birth and victory, and the nations of Gaul were gradually confounded under the name and government of the Franks. The Franks, after they mingled with their Gallic subjects, might have imparted the most valuable of human gifts, a spirit and system of constitutional liberty. Under a king, hereditary but limited, the chiefs and councillors might have debated at Paris in the palace of the Caesars. The adjacent field where the emperors reviewed their mercenary legions would have admitted the legislative assembly of freemen and warriors, and the rude model which had been sketched in the woods of Germany might have been polished and improved by the civil wisdom of the Romans. But the careless barbarians, secure of their personal independence, disdained the labor of government. The annual assemblies of the month of March were silently abolished, and the nation was separated and almost dissolved by the conquest of Gaul. The monarchy was left without any regular establishment of justice, of arms, or of revenue. The successors of Clovis wanted resolution to assume or strength to exercise the legislative and executive powers which the people had abdicated. The royal prerogative was distinguished only by a more ample privilege of rapine and murder, and the love of freedom, so often invigorated and disgraced by private ambition, was reduced among the licentious Franks to the contempt of order and the desire of impunity. 75 years after the death of Clovis, his grandson, Guntran, king of Burgundy, sent an army to invade the Gothic possessions of Septimania, or Languedoc. The troops of Burgundy, Berry, Auvergne, and the adjacent territories were excited by the hopes of spoil. They marched without discipline under the banners of German or Gallic counts. Their attack was feeble and unsuccessful. But the friendly and hostile provinces were desolated with indiscriminate rage. The cornfields, the villages, the churches themselves were consumed by fire. The inhabitants were massacred or dragged into captivity. And in the disorderly retreat, 5,000 of these inhuman savages were destroyed by hunger or intestine discord. When the pious Guntran reproached the guilt or neglect of their leaders and threatened to inflict not a legal sentence, but instant and arbitrary execution, they accused the universal and incurable corruption of the people. "No one," they said, "any longer fears or respects his king, his duke, or his count. Each man loves to do evil and freely indulges his criminal inclinations. The most gentle correction provokes an immediate tumult, and the rash magistrate who presumes to censure or restrain his seditious subjects seldom escapes alive from their revenge." It has been reserved for the same nation to expose, by their intemperate vices, the most odious abuse of freedom, and to supply its loss by the spirit of honor and humanity, which now alleviates and dignifies their obedience to an absolute sovereign. The Visigoths had resigned to Clovis the greatest part of their Gallic possessions, but their loss was amply compensated by the easy conquest and secure enjoyment of the provinces of Spain. From the monarchy of the Goths, which soon involved the Suevic kingdom of Galicia, the modern Spaniard still derived some national vanity. But the historian of the Roman Empire is neither invited nor compelled to pursue the obscure and barren series of their annals. The Goths of Spain were separated from the rest of mankind by the lofty range of the Pyrenean Mountains. Their manners and institutions, as far as they were common to the Germanic tribes, have been already explained. I have anticipated in the preceding chapter the most important of their ecclesiastical events, the fall of Arianism and the persecution of the Jews, and it only remains to observe some interesting circumstances which relate to the civil and ecclesiastical constitution of the Spanish kingdom. After their conversion from idolatry or heresy, the Frank and the Visigoths were disposed to embrace with equal submission the inherent evils and the accidental benefits of superstition. But the prelates of France, long before the extinction of the Merovingian race, had degenerated into fighting and hunting barbarians. They disdained the use of synods, forgot the laws of temperance and chastity, and preferred the indulgence of private ambition and luxury to the general interest of the sacerdotal profession. The bishops of Spain respected themselves and were respected by the public. Their indissoluble union disguised their vices and confirmed their authority, and the regular discipline of the church introduced peace, order, and stability into the government of the state. From the reign of Recared, the first Catholic king, to that of Witiza, the immediate predecessor of the unfortunate Rurik, 16 national councils were successively convened. The 6 metropolitans, Toledo, Seville, Mérida, Braga, Tarragona, and Narbonne, presided according to their respective seniority. The assembly was composed of their suffragan bishops who appeared in person or by their proxies, and a place was assigned to the most holy or opulent of the Spanish abbots. During the first 3 days of the convocation, as long as they agitated the ecclesiastical question of doctrine and discipline, the profane laity was excluded from their debates, which were conducted, however, with decent solemnity. But on the morning of the 4th day, the doors were thrown open for the entrance of the great officers of the palace, the dukes and counts of the provinces, the judges of the cities, and the Gothic nobles, and the decrees of heaven were ratified by the consent of the people. The same rules were observed in the provincial assemblies, the annual synods, which were empowered to hear complaints and to redress grievances, and a legal government was supported by the prevailing influence of the Spanish clergy. The bishops, who in each revolution were prepared to flatter the victorious and to insult the prostrate, labored with diligence and success to kindle the flames of persecution and to exalt the mitre above the crown. Yet the national councils of Toledo, in which the free spirit of the barbarians was tempered and guided by episcopal policy, have established some prudent laws for the common benefit of the king and people. The vacancy of the throne was supplied by the choice of the bishops and palatines, and after the failure of the line of Alaric, the regal dignity was still limited to the pure and noble blood of the Goths. The clergy, who anointed their lawful prince, always recommended and sometimes practiced the duty of allegiance, and the spiritual censures were denounced on the heads of the impious subjects who should resist his authority, conspire against his life, or violate, by an indecent union, the chastity even of his widow. But the monarch himself, when he ascended the throne, was bound by a reciprocal oath to God and his people that he would faithfully execute this important trust. The real or imaginary faults of his administration were subject to the control of a powerful aristocracy, and the bishops and palatines were guarded by fundamental privilege that they should not be degraded, imprisoned, tortured, nor punished with death, exile, or confiscation, unless by the free and public judgment of their peers. One of these legislative councils of Toledo examined and ratified the code of laws which had been compiled by a succession of Gothic kings, from the fierce Euric to the devout Aegica. As long as the Visigoths themselves were satisfied with the rude customs of their ancestors, they indulged their subjects of Aquitaine and Spain in the enjoyment of the Roman law. Their gradual improvement in arts, in policy, and at length in religion, encouraged them to imitate and to supersede these foreign institutions, and to compose a code of civil and criminal jurisprudence for the use of a great and united people. The same obligations and the same privileges were communicated to the nations of the Spanish monarchy, and the conquerors, insensibly renouncing the Teutonic idiom, submitted to the restraints of equity and exalted the Romans to the participation of freedom. The merit of this impartial policy was enhanced by the situation of Spain under the reign of the Visigoths. The provincials were long separated from their Arian masters by the irreconcilable difference of religion. After the conversion of Recared had removed the prejudices of the Catholics, the coasts, both of the ocean and Mediterranean, were still possessed by the Eastern emperors, who secretly excited a discontented people to reject the yoke of the barbarians and to assert the name and dignity of Roman citizens. The allegiance of doubtful subjects is indeed most effectually secured by their own persuasion that they hazard more in a revolt than they can hope to obtain by revolution. But it has appeared so natural to oppress those whom we hate and fear that the contrary system will deserve the praise of wisdom and moderation. While the kingdom of the Franks and Visigoths were established in Gaul and Spain, the Saxons achieved the conquest of Britain, the third great diocese of the prefecture of the West. Since Britain was already separated from the Roman Empire, I might without reproach decline a story familiar to the most illiterate and obscure to the most learned of my readers. The Saxons, who excelled in the use of the oar, or the battle axe, were ignorant of the art which could alone perpetuate the fame of their exploits. The provincials, relapsing into barbarism, neglected to describe the ruin of their country, and the doubtful tradition was almost extinguished before the missionaries of Rome restored the light of science and Christianity. The declamations of Gildas, the fragments or fables of Nennius, the obscure hints of the Saxon laws and chronicles, and the ecclesiastical tales of the venerable Bede, have been illustrated by the diligence and sometimes embellished by the fancy of succeeding writers, whose works I am not ambitious either to censure or to transcribe. Yet the historian of the empire may be tempted to pursue the revolutions of a Roman province till it vanishes from his sight, and an Englishman may curiously trace the establishment of the barbarians from whom he derives his names, his laws, and perhaps his origin. About 40 years after the dissolution of the Roman government, Vortigern appears to have obtained the supreme, though precarious, command of the princes and cities of Britain. That unfortunate monarch has been almost unanimously condemned for the weak and mischievous policy of inviting a formidable stranger to repel the vexatious inroads of a domestic foe. His ambassadors are dispatched by the gravest historians to the coast of Germany. They address a pathetic oration to the General Assembly of the Saxons, and those warlike barbarians resolve to assist with a fleet and army the suppliants of a distant and unknown island. If Britain had indeed been unknown to the Saxons, the measure of its calamities would have been less complete. But the strength of the Roman government could not always guard the maritime province against the pirates of Germany. The independent and divided states were exposed to their attacks, and the Saxons might sometimes join the Scots and the Picts in a tacit or express confederacy of rapine and destruction. Vortigern could only balance the various perils which assaulted on every side his throne and his people, and his policy may deserve either praise or excuse if he preferred the alliance of those barbarians whose naval power rendered them the most dangerous enemies and the most serviceable allies. Hengist and Horsa, as they ranged along the eastern coast with three ships, were engaged by the promise of an ample stipend to embrace the defence of Britain, and their intrepid valour soon delivered the country from the Caledonian invaders. The Isle of Thanet, a secure and fertile district, was allotted for the residence of these German auxiliaries, and they were supplied, according to the treaty, with a plentiful allowance of clothing and provisions. This favorable reception encouraged 5,000 warriors to embark with their families in 17 vessels, and the infant power of Hengist was fortified by this strong and seasonable reinforcement. The crafty barbarian suggested to Vortigern the obvious advantage of fixing in the neighborhood of the Picts a colony of faithful allies. A third fleet of 40 ships, under the command of his son and nephew, sailed from Germany, ravaged the Orkneys, and disembarked a new army on the coast of Northumberland, or Lothian, at the opposite extremity of the devoted land. It was easy to foresee, but it was impossible to prevent the impending evils. The two nations were soon divided and exasperated by mutual jealousies. The Saxons magnified all that they had done and suffered in the cause of an ungrateful people, while the Britons regretted the liberal rewards which could not satisfy the avarice of those haughty mercenaries. The causes of fear and hatred were inflamed into an irreconcilable quarrel. The Saxons flew to arms, and if they perpetrated a treacherous massacre during the security of a feast, they destroyed the reciprocal confidence which sustains the intercourse of peace and war. Hengist, who boldly aspired to the conquest of Britain, exhorted his countrymen to embrace the glorious opportunity. He painted in lively colors the fertility of the soil, the wealth of the cities, the pusillanimous temper of the natives, and the convenient situation of a spacious solitary island accessible on all sides to the Saxon fleets. The successive colonies, which issued in the period of a century from the mouths of the Elbe, the Weser, and the Rhine, were principally composed of three valiant tribes or nations of Germany: the Jutes, the Old Saxons, and the Angles. The Jutes, who fought under the peculiar banner of Hengist, assumed the merit of leading their countrymen in the paths of glory, and of erecting, in Kent, the first independent kingdom. The fame of the enterprise was attributed to the primitive Saxons, and the common laws and language of the conquerors are described by the national appellation of a people which, at the end of 400 years, produced the first monarchs of South Britain. The Angles were distinguished by their numbers and their success, and they claimed the honor of fixing a perpetual name on the country of which they occupied the most ample portion. The barbarians, who followed the hopes of rapine either on the land or sea, were insensibly blended with this triple confederacy. The Frisians, who had been tempted by their vicinity to the British shores, might balance, during a short space, the strength and reputation of the native Saxons. The Danes, the Prussians, the Rugians are faintly described, and some adventurous Huns, who had wandered as far as the Baltic, might embark on board the German vessels for the conquest of a new world. But this arduous achievement was not prepared or executed by the union of national powers. Each intrepid chieftain, according to the measure of his fame and fortunes, assembled his followers, equipped a fleet of 30 or perhaps of 60 vessels, chose the place of the attack, and conducted his subsequent operations according to the events of the war and the dictates of his private interest. In the invasion of Britain, many heroes vanquished and fell, but only 7 victorious leaders assumed, or at least maintained, the title of kings. 7 independent thrones, the Saxon Heptarchy, were founded by the conquerors and 7 families, one of which has been continued by female succession to our present sovereign, derived their equal and sacred lineage from Woden, the god of war. It has been pretended that this republic of kings was moderated by a general council and a supreme magistrate. But such an artificial scheme of policy is repugnant to the rude and turbulent spirit of the Saxons. Their laws are silent, and their imperfect annals afford only a dark and bloody prospect of intestine discord. A monk who, in the profound ignorance of a human life, has presumed to exercise the office of historian, strangely disfigures the state of Britain at the time of its separation from the Western Empire. Gildas describes in florid language the improvements of agriculture, the foreign trade which flowed with every tide into the Thames and the Severn, the solid and lofty construction of public and private edifices. He accuses the sinful luxury of the British people, of a people, according to the same writer, ignorant of the most simple arts, and incapable, without the aid of the Romans, of providing walls of stone or weapons of iron for the defense of their native land. Under the long dominion of the emperors, Britain had been insensibly molded into the elegant and servile form of a Roman province, whose safety was entrusted to a foreign power. The subjects of Honorius contemplated their new freedom with surprise and terror. They were left destitute of any civil or military constitution, and their uncertain rulers wanted either skill or courage or authority to direct the public force against the common enemy. The introduction of the Saxons betrayed their internal weakness and degraded the character both of the prince and people. Their consternation magnified the danger. The want of union diminished their resources, and the madness of civil factions was more solicitous to accuse than to remedy the evils which they imputed to the misconduct of their adversaries. Yet the Britons were not ignorant. They could not be ignorant of the manufacture or the use of arms. The successive and disorderly attacks of the Saxons allowed them to recover from their amazement, and the prosperous or adverse events of the war added discipline and experience to their native valor. While the continent of Europe and Africa yielded without resistance to the barbarians, the British island, alone and unaided, maintained a long, a vigorous, though an unsuccessful, struggle against the formidable pirates who almost at the same instant assaulted the northern, the eastern, and the southern coasts. The cities, which had been fortified with skill, were defended with resolution. The advantages of ground, hills, forests, and morasses were diligently improved by the inhabitants. The conquest of each district was purchased with blood, and the defeats of the Saxons are strongly attested by the discreet silence of their annalist. Hengist might hope to achieve the conquest of Britain, but his ambition in an active reign of 35 years was confined to the possession of Kent, and the numerous colony which he had planted in the north was extirpated by the sword of the Britons. The monarchy of the West Saxons was laboriously founded by the persevering efforts of 3 martial generations. The life of Cerdic, one of the bravest of the children of Woden, was consumed in the conquest of Hampshire and the Isle of Wight, and the loss which he sustained in the Battle of Mount Badon reduced him to a state of inglorious repose. Kenric, his valiant son, advanced into Wiltshire, besieged Salisbury, at that time seated on a commanding eminence, and vanquished an army which advanced to the relief of the city. In the subsequent Battle of Marlborough, his British enemies displayed their military science. Their troops were formed in 3 lines. Each line consisted of 3 distinct bodies, and the cavalry, the archers, and the pikemen were distributed according to the principles of Roman tactics. The Saxons charged in 1 weighty column, boldly encountered with their short swords the long lances of the Britons, and maintained an equal conflict till the approach of night. 2 decisive victories, the death of three British kings, and the reduction of Cirencester, Bath, and Gloucester, established the fame and power of Coilin, the grandson of Cedric, who carried his victorious arms to the banks of the Severn. After a war of 100 years, the independent Britons still occupy the whole extent of the western coast, from the walls of Antoninus to the extreme promontory of Cornwall, and the principal cities of the inland country still oppose the arms of the barbarians. Resistance became more languid as the number and boldness of the assailants continually increased. Winning their way by slow and painful efforts, the Saxons, the Angles, and their various confederates advanced from the north, from the east, and from the south, till their victorious banners were united in the centre of the island. Beyond the Severn, the Britons still asserted their national freedom, which survived the Heptarchy, and even the monarchy of the Saxons. The bravest warriors, who preferred exile to slavery, found a secure refuge in the mountains of Wales. The reluctant submission of Cornwall was delayed for some ages, and a band of fugitives acquired a settlement in Gaul by their own valour, or the liberality of the Merovingian kings. The western angle of Armorica acquired the new appellations of Cornwall and the Lesser Britain, and the vacant lands of the Osismi were filled by a strange people who, under the authority of their counts and bishops, preserved the laws and language of their ancestors. To the feeble descendants of Clovis and Charlemagne, the Britons of Armorica refused the customary tribute, subdued the neighbouring dioceses of Vannes, Rennes, and Nantes, and formed a powerful, though vassal, state which has been united to the crown of France. Part 5. In a century of perpetual, or at least implacable, war, much courage and some skill must have been exerted for the defence of Britain. Yet if the memory of its champions is almost buried in oblivion, we need not repine, since every age, however destitute of science or virtue, sufficiently abounds with acts of blood and military renown. The tomb of Vortimer, the son of Vortigern, was erected on the margin of the seashore as a landmark formidable to the Saxons, whom he had thrice vanquished in the fields of Kent. Ambrosius Aurelian was descended from a noble family of Romans. His modesty was equal to his valour, and his valour, till the last fatal action, was crowned with splendid success. But every British name is effaced by the illustrious name of Arthur, the hereditary prince of the Silures in South Wales, and the elective king or general of the nation. According to the most rational account, he defeated in 12 successive battles the Angles of the north and the Saxons of the west. But the declining age of the hero was embittered by popular ingratitude and domestic misfortunes. The events of his life are less interesting than the singular revolutions of his fame. During a period of 500 years, the tradition of his exploits was preserved and rudely embellished by the obscure bards of Wales and Armorica, who were odious to the Saxons and unknown to the rest of mankind. The pride and curiosity of the Norman conquerors prompted them to inquire into the ancient history of Britain. They listened with fond credulity to the tale of Arthur, and eagerly applauded the merit of a prince who had triumphed over the Saxons, their common enemies. His romance, transcribed in the Latin of Geoffrey of Monmouth, and afterwards translated into the fashionable idiom of the times, was enriched with the various, though incoherent, ornaments which were familiar to the experience, the learning, or the fancy of the 12th century. The progress of a Phrygian colony, from the Tiber to the Thames, was easily engrafted on the fable of the Aeneid, and the royal ancestors of Arthur derived their origin from Troy and claimed their alliance with the Caesars. His trophies were decorated with captive provinces and imperial titles, and his Danish victories avenged the recent injuries of his country. The gallantry and superstition of the British hero, his feasts and tournaments, and the memorable institution of his Knights of the Round Table were faithfully copied from the reigning manners of chivalry, and the fabulous exploits of Uther's son appear less incredible than the adventures which were achieved by the enterprising valour of the Normans. Pilgrimage and the Holy Wars introduced into Europe the specious miracles of Arabian magic. Fairies and giants, flying dragons and enchanted palaces were blended with the more simple fictions of the West, and the fate of Britain depended on the art or the predictions of Merlin. Every nation embraced and adorned the popular romance of Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table. Their names were celebrated in Greece and Italy, and the voluminous tales of Sir Lancelot and Sir Tristram were devoutly studied by the princes and nobles who disregarded the genuine heroes and historians of antiquity. At length the light of science and reason was rekindled. The talisman was broken, the visionary fabric melted into air, and by a natural, though unjust, reverse of the public opinion, the severity of the present age is inclined to question the existence of Arthur. Resistance, if it cannot avert, must increase the miseries of conquest, and conquest has never appeared more dreadful and destructive than in the hands of the Saxons, who hated the valour of their enemies, disdained the faith of treaties, and violated without remorse the most sacred objects of the Christian worship. The fields of battle might be traced almost in every district by monuments of bones. The fragments of falling towers were stained with blood. The last of the Britons, without distinction of age or sex, was massacred in the ruins of Anderida. And the repetition of such calamities was frequent and familiar under the Saxon Heptarchy. The arts and religion, the laws and language which the Romans had so carefully planted in Britain, were extirpated by their barbarous successors. After the destruction of the principal churches, the bishops who had declined the crown of martyrdom retired with the holy relics into Wales and Armorica. The remains of their flocks were left destitute of any spiritual food. The practice and even the remembrance of Christianity were abolished, and the British clergy might obtain some comfort from the damnation of the idolatrous strangers. The kings of France maintained the privileges of their Roman subjects, but the ferocious Saxons trampled on the laws of Rome and of the emperors. The proceedings of civil and criminal jurisdiction, the titles of honour, the forms of office, the ranks of society, and even the domestic rites of marriage, testament, and inheritance were finally suppressed. And the indiscriminate crowd of noble and plebeian slaves was governed by the traditionary customs which had been coarsely framed for the shepherds and pirates of Germany. The language of science, of business, and of conversation which had been introduced by the Romans was lost in the general desolation. A sufficient number of Latin or Celtic words might be assumed by the Germans to express their new wants and ideas, but those illiterate pagans preserved and established the use of their national dialect. Almost every name conspicuous either in the church or state reveals its Teutonic origin, and the geography of England was universally inscribed with foreign characters and appellations. The example of a revolution so rapid and so complete may not easily be found, but it will excite a probable suspicion that the arts of Rome were less deeply rooted in Britain than in Gaul or Spain, and that the native rudeness of the country and its inhabitants was covered by a thin varnish of Italian manners. This strange alteration has persuaded historians and even philosophers that the provincials of Britain were totally exterminated, and that the vacant land was again peopled by the perpetual influx and rapid increase of the German colonies. 300,000 Saxons are said to have obeyed the summons of Hengist. The entire emigration of the Angles was attested in the age of Bede by the solitude of their native country, and our experience has shown the free propagation of the human race if they are cast on a fruitful wilderness where their steps are unconfined and their subsistence is plentiful. The Saxon kingdoms displayed the face of recent discovery and cultivation. The towns were small, the villages were distant, the husbandry was languid and unskillful. 4 sheep were equivalent to an acre of the best land. An ample space of wood and morass was resigned to the vague dominion of nature, and the modern bishopric of Durham, the whole territory from the Tyne to the Tees had returned to its primitive state of a savage and solitary forest. Such imperfect population might have been supplied in some generations by the English colonies, but neither reason nor facts can justify the unnatural supposition that the Saxons of Britain remained alone in the desert which they had subdued. After the sanguinary barbarians had secured their dominion and gratified their revenge, it was their interest to preserve the peasants as well as the cattle of the unresisting country. In each successive revolution, the patient herd becomes the property of its new masters, and the salutary compact of food and labour is silently ratified by their mutual necessities. Wilfrid, the apostle of Sussex, accepted from his royal convert the gift of the peninsula of Selsey, near Chichester, with the persons and property of its inhabitants, who then amounted to 87 families. He released them at once from spiritual and temporal bondage, and 250 slaves of both sexes were baptized by their indulgent master. The kingdom of Sussex, which spread from the sea to the Thames, contained 7,000 families. 1,200 were ascribed to the Isle of Wight, and if we multiply this vague computation, it may seem probable that England was cultivated by a million of servants, or villeins, who were attached to the estates of their arbitrary landlords. The indigent barbarians were often tempted to sell their children or themselves into perpetual and even foreign bondage. Yet the special exemptions which were granted to national slaves sufficiently declare that they were much less numerous than the strangers and captives who had lost their liberty or changed their masters by the accidents of war. When time and religion had mitigated the fierce spirit of the Anglo-Saxons, the laws encouraged the frequent practice of manumission, and their subjects, of Welsh or Cambrian extraction, assumed the respectable station of inferior freemen, possessed of lands, and entitled to the rights of civil society. Such gentle treatment might secure the allegiance of a fierce people who had been recently subdued on the confines of Wales and Cornwall. The sage Ina, the legislator of Wessex, united the two nations in the hands of domestic alliance, and four British lords of Somersetshire may be honourably distinguished in the court of a Saxon monarch. The independent Britons appear to have relapsed into the state of original barbarism from whence they had been imperfectly reclaimed. Separated by their enemies from the rest of mankind, they soon became an object of scandal and abhorrence to the Catholic world. Christianity was still professed in the mountains of Wales, but the rude schismatics, in the form of the clerical tonsure, and in the day of the celebration of Easter, obstinately resisted the imperious mandates of the Roman pontiffs. The use of the Latin language was insensibly abolished, and the Britons were deprived of the art and learning which Italy communicated to her Saxon proselytes. In Wales and Armorica, the Celtic tongue, the native idiom of the West, was preserved and propagated, and the bards who had been the companions of the Druids were still protected in the 16th century by the laws of Elizabeth. Their chief, a respectable officer of the courts of Penguin, or Aberfraw, or Caermarthen, accompanied the king's servants to war. The monarchy of the Britons, which he sung in front of battle, excited their courage and justified their depredations, and the songster claimed for his legitimate prize the fairest heifer of the spoil. His subordinate ministers, the masters and disciples of vocal and instrumental music, visited in their respective circuits the royal, the noble, and the plebeian houses, and the public poverty, almost exhausted by the clergy, was oppressed by the importunate demands of the bards. Their rank and merit were ascertained by solemn trials, and the strong belief of supernatural inspiration exalted the fancy of the poet and of his audience. The last retreats of Celtic freedom, the extreme territories of Gaul and Britain, were less adapted to agriculture than to pasturage. The wealth of the Britons consisted in their flocks and herds. Milk and flesh were their ordinary food, and bread